Hi, it's Megan. Before we get to the episode, I want to tell you about the latest development for my project, The Unspeakeasy. It's called the Unspeakeasy School of Thought. As you probably know, The Unspeakeasy's flagship offerings were in-person retreats and an online community for women. Those are not going anywhere. But beginning in April, we'll be offering courses for everyone with an emphasis on intellectual curiosity, artistry over identity, humor, and of course, nuance. We're kicking things off with three writing courses, a fiction workshop taught by novelist Chailey Widger, a script writing workshop taught by Hollywood veteran Sam Wolfson, and a memoir and personal essay workshop taught by legendary author Sherman Alexie. Now, that class will focus on a genre I just invented, the cancellation story, which can mean anything from getting canceled professionally to losing your best friend over politics. You don't need to have written anything yet. That's what the workshop is for. Sherman's classic novel, The Absolutely True Diary of a Part-Time Indian, has sold millions of copies worldwide and is taught in thousands of classrooms every year. Sherman also knows a thing or two about being canceled, which you might have heard about if you listened to my recent Unspeakable podcast interview with him. This is an incredible opportunity to study with amazing teachers. So if you're interested, go to theunspeakeasy.com. Pull down the School of Thought menu and find out how to apply. Classes begin the week of April 15th. They take place on Zoom, and the application deadline is April 8th. We'd love to hear from you.
Having someone to talk to when you feel alone in the world is undeniably a good thing, right? The question is having someone who is not just a friend, or not just supportive, but suggesting, actually, you may have a mental health diagnosis. Let's talk. You sound a little speck to me. You sound a little like you may have a little bit of bipolar. The number of therapists who casually throw around diagnoses is stunning.
Welcome to the Unspeakable Podcast. I'm your host, Megan Daum. My guest is journalist Abigail Schreier. She's here to talk about her new book, Bad Therapy, Why the Kids Aren't Growing Up. In it, she reports on how the mental health crisis among young people, which is something that is well known by now and that we've discussed here many times, not only results in, but in her view, is often caused by mediocre clinicians, flawed research, overzealous prescribing of medications, and maybe above all, a societal obsession with trauma and emotional injury. The net effect of all of this, Abigail says, is a lot of unnecessary misery. I've been an admirer of Abigail's for a long time, so I was really happy to get her on the podcast. Her 2020 book, Irreversible Damage, was among the very first to shed light on the huge increase in kids, especially girls, identifying as transgender. Again, another thing we talk about a lot around here, and the explosion in medical treatment, including surgery, to affirm their beliefs. Though that book was immensely successful, much of the mainstream press, or okay, all of it, seemed to think it itself was an agent of harm. And we talk about the ways in which her new book, though less controversial, may make people feel uneasy in some of the same ways. I should stress that Abigail is in no way opposed to therapy for anyone, kids or adults, who really need it. But the question of whether we've therapized ourselves into a collective nervous breakdown is a good one, I think. And I found Abigail's answers reassuring, even as they sounded an alarm. As always, paying subscribers hear the whole interview. If you are not yet a paying subscriber, you're going to hear half. So go to megandaum.substack.com and join us to hear the whole thing. And here is my conversation with Abigail Schreier. Abigail Schreier, welcome to The Unspeakable.
Oh, it's great to talk to you, Megan. Thank you so much for having me on.
We have a lot to talk about. This book, Bad Therapy, Why the Kids Aren't Growing Up, covers a lot of ground, and I know it's resonating with many, many people. I want to start by asking you, though, about what it was like when you grew up. You grew up in the 1980s, I think, mostly. I think you're a little bit younger than I am.
Yeah.
What kind of childhood did you have? And what was your relationship to your own feelings?
Wow, what an interesting question. So I grew up in the tail end of Gen X. I was born in 1978, and I grew up mostly in suburban Maryland in a county called Prince George's County, which was, I think it's the most affluent majority African-American county in the country, or last I checked it was. Maybe that's out of date. But basically, it's like a lot of middle-class and upper-middle-class African-Americans, mostly, you know, middle class. So I grew up in a street that was very, very integrated. And, you know, it's kind of funny. Like, we were the only Jewish family on the street. And the doctor that we always asked our medical questions of was African American, which is sort of the reverse of what most people experience is. But we, you know, my parents were lawyers. So it was a very sort of, you know, typically American upbringing, a suburban upbringing in a certain sense. You know, what was my relationship to feelings? I think my parents had a certain, you know, I heard things like knock it off, or, you know, shake it off, or you'll live. Those were things that were said a lot not just in my house, or cut it out, you know, not just in my house, but in a lot of houses in America. And I think, you know, mostly we did. Now, I think there was a huge prejudice when I was growing up that therapy was for the mentally ill, and only the mentally ill, and that you were kind of crazy if you saw a therapist, and it was something to be embarrassed about. And I think, for very understandable and good reason, you know, as my generation got older, we wanted to destigmatize therapy, because, of course, there are a lot of reasons a person might want to go to a therapist, and it doesn't mean you're crazy, and it can be helpful, and a lot of people feel that it's helpful, and they shouldn't be shamed for that. And I think that was a very, very noble impulse, and I think it was, you know, mostly correct. Where I, you know, tend to think we went off track was assuming therapy for kids was the same as therapy for adults.
Right. Yeah. So I grew up in the 70s and I was a teenager in the 80s. And I mean, I guess I remember, like, there might have been a couple of kids who were like really, really messed up. And maybe you heard about those kids going to therapy or something like that. Like the kind of kids that now, I mean, God knows they would be shuffled off into any number of treatment programs. But, you know, that was really the only time you heard about that. And you didn't even hear of adults going to therapy that much. I mean, I guess I learned about therapy through watching Woody Allen movies. Like, that was kind of...
That's exactly,
you know,
right.
That was, yeah, the template, right? So it was analysis. You would lie on the couch and just talk a stream of consciousness. So then, did you go to therapy ever as a young woman?
No, I never went to therapy, though it was threatened a lot by my father. If I didn't stop fighting with my mother, because I fought with her constantly as a teenager, if I didn't stop fighting with my mother, who's going to put us both in therapy, or certainly me in therapy, because he couldn't take it anymore. But my father also, you know, I mean, that was kind of the threat, but he also said to me explicitly many times, you know, there might be a time in your life where you feel like you can go to you should go to therapy if you ever want to. You should know that there's no shame in it. You know, plenty of adults have been to therapy. I have been to therapy, and, you know, plenty of adults find it helpful, or plenty of people, he's, you know, and that I shouldn't be ashamed of it. So even though that was occasionally the threat in our household, my dad also actually made it clear that there was nothing wrong with going to therapy necessarily, and that, if, you know, that I shouldn't be ashamed of it if I ever needed to.
Okay, so that's interesting. All right, so that's kind of where you came from. Cut to, it is the 20, whatever it is, it's 2020, getting into 2020, and we're now in 2024. When did you start noticing that there was something peculiar going on with kids and their relationship to therapy and therapists?
Well, I noticed we were swimming in this diagnostic language. See, I noticed parents were saying, oh, that's my ADHD kid. Oh, and kids were saying of themselves, oh, because of my anxiety. They were absolutely speaking, understanding themselves. Parents were understanding their children. Children were understanding themselves entirely by the language of psychopathology. Now, I'm not the only one who noticed this, of course. You know, people have been writing about it now for a decade. And what they have noticed is nobody's shy in this generation. They have social phobia. Nobody's worried. You never hear the word worried. You only hear, I have anxiety. And you never hear, I don't know, I'm feeling really blue. You never hear that today. It's always, I'm depressed.
Right. Was this something that you were noticing, like, with your own children's friends, or were you noticing this as a journalist, or was this sort of in your personal life?
So I was mostly noticing it with friends and kids, the way people would speak to kids and about kids. They were always trying to understand them and talk about their feelings. And they were these kids had a shocking number of diagnoses. So you would see kids, two in a family with diagnosed with ADHD. And then you would say to the parents, did you have ADHD? No. Did your siblings have ADHD? No. Well, then why do both of your kids have ADHD? Now, I wouldn't say all that, but I was always kind of, well, that's curious. Why in this generation, you know, with parents, neither of whom had this diagnosis? And of course, the standard answer is always, well, I had undiagnosed ADHD. Okay, but you seem to have muddled through without stimulants. So why did you rush to get your kids on stimulants?
I feel like I hear a lot of parents, especially mothers, saying that they now have their own ADHD diagnoses. Like, oh, my kid got a diagnosis and then I realized I have it too. I mean, you also hear this with autism, by the way. But let's look at a timeline here. So when did this start to happen? Is this like the 90s or was it after that? Like, what's the trajectory here?
It's a great question. I'm not sure I have a clear answer on when this started. I know 10 years ago, I think now 15 years ago, a writer for Slate noticed that no one was correcting kids' bad behavior and that they were using only the language of psychopathology to talk about kids.
Can you believe that was in Slate?
It was in
take
Slate.
Take a moment and contemplate that. Okay.
Exactly. I mean, Slate's changed a lot, but they were noticing that nobody said, oh gosh, he's badly behaved. And it's true. I haven't heard that in ages. They hear he has oppositional defiance disorder. So we had completely given up a moral framework for understanding child behavior. And that seems to have happened sometime in the last 20 years. But also, all these kids were getting diagnosed. Now, I think it's between the ages of 12 and 17, something like 20% of American boys have an ADHD diagnosis. Now, that suggests just in itself is so bizarre that it suggests there's either something in the environment or we're diagnosing fairly normal behavior, right? It's not rare at that point.
Okay. And what does ADHD actually entail? It stands for attention deficit hyperactive disorder, right? So what does it mean exactly?
It's a great question. You know, there are a lot of things. They give these parents these surveys, and based on that, often the pediatrician will assign a diagnosis. Do you think your child is more hyperactive? You know, you get these questions that lead to you to decide whether you think your kid is more or less hyperactive, more or less attentive than other kids. So more or less easily distracted. Distractibility is a big one. But, you know, they rarely start by saying, well, what, like, tell me about your kid's environment. What are you doing in the environment? I mean, I'll give you an example. I interviewed this wonderful woman who's the head of the emotions lab at Georgetown University. Her name is Yulia Chentsova-Dutton. And she does cross-cultural studies of things like emotion regulation. She looks at ADHD and other things. And one of the things she told me was that in other classrooms, she showed me pictures of classrooms in China, in Russia, in all kinds of countries all over the world, and they're so clean. And the only interesting thing is at the front of the room, maybe they have some letters up, you know, the ABCs, that sort of thing. So it's, she was basically saying, look how easy it is to pay attention to the teachers. Now, look at the average elementary school classroom in America. And it looks like Mardi Gras, right? It is, I mean, you've got pictures everywhere. You've got things hanging from the ceiling. And she said, Americans consider that basically happy. Like, you don't want to make your kids sad. You make them happy by putting pictures all over the walls. And in fact, teachers often complain, oh, I barely have a budget for decorating the class the way I need to, right?
Decorating. Right. They don't have a decorating budget.
Right. Well, you know, I'll tell you just in my kids' first grade classroom, I thought about it immediately. They had a working, this is not a joke, they had a working, what are they called? Street signal. you know, green, yellow, red.
Traffic light.
Traffic light, sorry. They had a working traffic light. And basically the teacher would use it as a prop to teach grammar or something. Like, oh, you know, in Sentence City, the whole gag was that this was a, you know, they were teaching grammar with, you know, stop and yellow and green, whatever. But, you know, there's nothing wrong with that as a pedagogical tool, but it gives you some sense. And there was, an enormous doll, you know, it was supposed to be a policeman. And the idea was we were going to police grammar and we're going to learn about grammar. And it was actually great, you know, a fun teaching tool. But it gives you some idea of how permanently cluttered and crazy the average elementary school, you know, classroom is. And if you look at elementary school, they are completely decked out. Now, we also give kids screens like crazy. So the amount of sort of titillation that kids get is a lot. And then when they're inattentive, we assume there's something wrong with their brains.
Oh my God, that is so interesting. I have never thought about that before, the sort of like maximalist aesthetic of the elementary school classroom. I mean, I'm thinking about like this concept of experience design, you know, like they always say, like, or I used to joke that, you know, like walking into an Anthropology store, for instance, is like for women, it's like a mental orgasm or something. Like there's something so like these, you know, these kinds of spaces have been designed for like maximum stimulation to get people to buy things, right?
Right.
And there's the same principle is being applied to these classrooms, obviously based on some kind of evidence, presumably, but that makes perfect sense.
I don't think it is based on evidence.
I think it's based on too much credit.
Yeah, I think it's based on a gut reaction that happy means lots of colors and decoration. And by the way, there's nothing necessarily wrong with that. And I think a lot of these things are based on a good impulse. But if you want a kid now to concentrate on the two sounds made by the letter E, which is terribly boring, by the way, right?
Right.
And you've got this crazy, exciting, decorated classroom, it's going to be a lot harder to get their attention. Now, it's also going to be harder if they've sat on an iPad this morning. There's all kinds of things we do to make kids less attentive. And putting aside, you know, your judgment on, you know, how kids are being raised and how much tech they get and everything else, there's no question that they're going to have more trouble concentrating. And our solution is almost never, well, let's see what we can do in the environment. Our solution right away is to put these kids on a major stimulant.
Yeah. I'm glad you mentioned Dr. Yulia Chentsova-Dutton because she has one of the more memorable quotes in the book. And this has to do with just the nature of feelings themselves and kids' relationship to their own feelings, which is kind of what I was asking you about in the beginning. She says, adults should be telling kids how imperfect and unreliable their emotions can be. Can you talk more about that?
Sure. So today, you know, I call this sort of therapeutic parenting, and we're all sort of awash in therapy in a certain sense. But basically the idea that's taken over much of parenting is that you should always elicit, you know, or solicit your kids' feelings. How are you feeling about this? Did you like your ice cream? Do you like your, you know, did you have fun at the park? Tell me how you're feeling about everything. And Yulia, who studies emotions and emotion regulation and will tell you that American, you know, adolescents have some of the worst emotional regulation, you know, of the different cultures she studies, she says partly because they believe it's always a good signal, a trustworthy signal to whether they are entitled to be upset or whether something is wrong or whether they have been harmed, whereas it's not true. Emotions are labile, right? They're always changing. And sometimes we feel emotions that are totally out of whack to what has actually happened to us, right? We may feel jealous of people who have something we don't even want.
Right.
We might feel hurt by something someone said when it was completely well-intentioned. We might feel that we really love someone who's only treated us badly. So, you know, emotions fool us all the time, and people who study emotions know this. Unfortunately, by constantly asking kids, how do you feel? How do you feel? Tell me your feelings. What you're saying to them is your emotions are so important, and they're a reliable guide. So let's take them really, really seriously. It's the opposite of what we should do, and it makes them more dysregulated.
Yeah, and, you know, one thing I always wonder, too, is, like, why is it that Gen X is so prone to being this way with their own kids. Like, there's this weird paradox, right? Because Gen Xers, we're always patting ourselves on the back about how resilient we are. And we were the latchkey kids. And, you know, we walked home, you know, uphill both ways to school when we were seven and smoked cigarettes on the way, et cetera, et cetera. Like, it's almost like a competing to who had the least attentive parents sort of thing. I was actually just talking about this with Ted and Courtney Ballacher. They were the directors of the film version of The Coddling of the American Mind, right? And so, like, this kinds of questions come up a lot. But, you know, Gen X, as parents, and I'm not a parent myself, but I see this all the time in my cohort, we are the most hovering, overprotective, constantly rushing in parents. And it's like the opposite of how we were raised and what we pride in ourselves. So what do you think is going on there?
So it's really interesting. I think one of the things that's going on is that we entered therapy. And in certainly in larger numbers than previous generations. And partly, you know, we had had tough childhoods in certain respect. Our parents divorced in rates that America had never seen before. And we were experimenting sexually at younger ages than America had seen. Remember, I don't know if you remember the blowjob panic of middle schools.
The rainbow parties? Was this the thing?
Oh, is that what they were called?
Actually, I remember I wrote a column about this when I was at the LA Times. Yeah, there was some kind of panic where, like, the girls would put on different colors of lipstick.
Yes,
and then their boy would have, like, this rainbow colored, yeah.
Okay, yes, you can imagine. That's right.
Yes,
exactly.
So I don't know if that actually ever happened or not, but.
I mean, I remember, there was certainly, I remember reading about, like, blowjobs in bathrooms was a big, like, moral panic or of the, you know, of the 90s and in the public school bathrooms, you know. But I think it was true. There was a lot of sexual experimentation very, very young. I mean, this is, you know, middle school, high school, whatever, you know, very young. And I think that people felt like, you know, I should take these problems, you know, my parents divorced. I never really got to process it. No one cared about my emotions. And I think as a generation, we had a really good experience with therapy, but also we had all these movies and media. We had everything from Good Will Hunting, the Sopranos, encouraging us in the idea that the therapist is how you get better. It's how you have to, you know, talk about your hard childhood and that will help you put it behind you. And we really thought of therapy as the solution to becoming, you know, stable adults.
Yeah. And, you know, I perceived therapy as a marker of sophistication. So,
oh, yes.
I mean, I remember when I went to therapy for the first time when I was, like, in my early 20s and I was living in New York and I thought that that was, like, just what you did. This, like, oh,
totally.
I'm a grown up now. I have a real job. I, you know, have, like, you know, some decent clothes, nothing great, but I'm going through the motions here. And so, okay, here's the next step and I'm going to go to therapy. And I actually didn't really have much to say. I don't know what, I was situationally unhappy. So I thought somehow going to therapy would, you know, solve that. And I wonder if, okay, well, actually I'm going to ask you this. Are there more therapists now than there used to be? And are they, I don't want to say not as qualified, although maybe I am saying that. Are they of a different mentality? Because when I was, you know, it was in the early 90s, I was, like, in my first job and living in New York and felt they were coming from a psychoanalytic tradition, right? Like, those were the nature of the conversations were, you know, fairly sophisticated. I feel like in the 30 years since, we've got a whole lot of people hanging up a shingle and calling themselves therapists. And I wonder how much that is affecting just the overall kind of quality of treatment.
Yes to both questions. So here's the thing to know. Between 1946 and 1960, membership in the American Psychological Association quadrupled. And then between 1970 and 1995, it quadrupled again.
Wow.
We had a vast expansion in the mental health profession. And here's the thing. They weren't treating the sick. They were mostly doing what's called preventive mental health care. So they were mostly treating the worried well. And now today, everyone hangs out a shingle. You have people with 1 year, you know, MFT or school counseling degrees. I'm sure some people will say, mine took 2 years. I don't know. But, you know, some of these can be done in a year. and they are ready to do things like offer a diagnosis for bipolar disorder. Now, let me tell you, having someone to talk to when you feel alone in the world is undeniably a good thing, right? The question is having someone who is not just a friend or not just supportive, but suggesting, actually, you may have a mental health diagnosis. Let's talk. You sound a little speck to me. You sound a little like you may have a little bit of bipolar. The number of therapists who casually throw around diagnoses is stunning. And let me tell you something else. Giving someone a diagnosis is not nothing. There's great research on this. It can absolutely change a person's self-understanding and their sense of what they're capable of, their efficacy, their power in the world to do things. You can rob them of that. Now, let me just say, I'm not worried about therapy for adults because an adult is an adult. And an adult can say, all right, mate, she thinks I have bipolar disorder. I'm not sure. I'm not sure about that.
or I'm going to now see myself as a bipolar person. But that's a whole other conversation.
Maybe, but I'm one of those people with a strong prejudice that you, in a liberal society, you trust adults to know what's right for them. Mm-hmm. That's just a strong prejudice I have. And by the way, tons of adults are writing to me right now telling me they spent 30 years in therapy and they're just as depressed as ever and it didn't do anything for them and that kind of thing.
That's so, on them.
Right. Exactly. Right. Exactly. Yeah. That's on them. But here's the problem. Parents are signing up their kids prophylactically at the first sign of distress with a therapist or with a diagnosis or with a psychiatric drug of some sort, with no sense that they may be profoundly exposing their kids to harms. And yes, even with therapy, because therapy involves risks, but a child is not in a position to say, you know, look, I wasn't nice that my mom said that, but I wouldn't call her toxic. I don't think it counts as emotional abuse just because she yelled at me.
Is this just an extension of the professionalization of sort of parenthood itself? Like, I mean, these parents they're hiring tutors and they're hiring, you know, specialists to help with any number of subject fields or interests or, you know, particular problems. And, you know, these sorts of diagnoses, and I don't want to diminish them because, you know, there are people close to me who their kids have these diagnoses, but like, let's just take something like sensory processing disorder. Okay. Like,
which is not a recognized disorder.
And what does that mean?
Right. So sensory processing, you know, I'm always afraid I'm going to get in trouble when I talk about diagnoses because people are saying, no, that's not true. But look, the DSM has expanded rapidly and vastly. I mean, it's just, they have now, you know, and a lot of wonderful psychiatrists, you know, people like Alan Francis have come out and said, you know, we're really pathologizing normal life here. But sensory processing disorder has not yet made it in, as far as the last time I checked, to the DSM. Nonetheless, tons of people will tell you they have it. Sensory processing issues are typically a symptom that you find with other disorders where, you know, some people are sensitive, you know, especially sensitive or reactive to certain sensory stimuli in the environment. Okay. So you can, a psychiatrist might, or a neuropsychologist might debate the validity of these various diagnoses. Okay. But here's what I want to say, because I'm a journalist. And let me just say that the number of people who casually refer to and accommodate any number of sensitivities in their kids is really astonishing. Like they will casually drop, oh, he has sensory processing issues. What does that mean? Well, he doesn't like loud sounds. And so they try to quiet everything around the child. He doesn't like harsh textures. He's a sensory processing kid. Well, we all know that when you accommodate anxieties, you know, this is great research on this, and this has been out for decades now. When you accommodate a child's anxiety and you allow that child to avoid the stimuli, you're very often making the problem worse, making the distress worse. And that's what so many people seem to be doing with their kids. They try to make their kids constantly, you know, accommodate every worry, avoid every possible pain. And then they have these hypersensitive children. And then unfortunately, they pat themselves on the back effectively as, oh, I just have a very sensitive child. He's just very sensitive. But very often it's very flattering to the parent to, because they're the ones who were sensitive enough to notice the child's sensitivity, never suspecting that in many cases, no, actually, they created the sensitive child by being overly reactive to everything in the kid's environment and helping the kid avoid stimuli.
I mean, I wanted to, this is exactly what I was going to ask you. Like, what are the parents getting out of this? Like, is it because they're so busy or they're working or they're distracted and they feel guilty, so they overcompensate? You've talked to so many parents. Were there any patterns that you recognized?
So I will tell you this. First of all, Megan, I have to tell you that, you know, answering a question about Gen X with a woman who's written such a fantastic book about Gen X, The Problem with Everything, which just adored, is a little daunting, but I'll give it a stab.
No, not at all. Please. I talk about generations too often, I think. I find it fascinating, but
listen,
it's easy to kind of just fall back into it. But yeah. But go ahead.
But I'll just say a few things. You know, I think as a generation, we became convinced that anything could emotionally traumatize our children. We really bought into the trauma narrative, and we became absolutely frantic. We exaggerated our own childhoods, the pain in them. We didn't remember all the things we recovered from and played on because we were told, knock it off, you're fine, go back to the soccer field. We remember the one time we played on a legitimately sprained ankle, and we're so upset that no one was there for us and noticed it. So we're vastly overcorrecting. And so instead we're deciding, and we don't punish. We don't punish our kids. Now, when I say we don't punish, I don't mean beating, and I don't even mean spanking, because we really gave those up. Mm-hmm. But I mean, we don't even want to punish a kid by taking away the iPad, sending them to their room, telling them the word no. Millennial parents especially try to avoid the word no. And
really?
You can imagine how this prepares a kid.
That no means no. What happened to consent? Wait a second. they've blown all their no capital on a consent scenarios. So now there's no more no's left. I don't know.
Right. And then these kids show up in school, and lo and behold, a teacher needs them to behave. And the teacher needs them to behave as one of 25 other students. The kid's never heard the word no, has no structure, never had a toy taken away from him when he hit his sister with it. And now the teacher wants him to sit down and listen to the lesson. And he doesn't want to do it. He's never been told that he needs to. He hasn't sort of exercised that muscle, if you will. And so what does the teacher say? I think your kid has ADHD.
Let's talk about medications, because I'm assuming that this might be a moment where the idea of medications might be introduced. You talk a lot in the book about how these medications were never designed to be used on children, and yet they...
That was the first part of my conversation with journalist Abigail Schreier. Her new book is Bad Therapy: Why the Kids Aren't Growing Up. You want to hear the rest of the interview? Become a paying subscriber at megandaum.substack.com. That's MEGHANDAUM. Becoming a paying subscriber gets you a lot of perks, including, frankly, being able to hear the whole episode every week. So you might as well do it now. I'll be back next week with another super nuanced guest. Thanks for listening. See you then.